Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 22nd, 2006. Our session today is entitled V.I. Lenin and the Russian Revolution. Our presenter is Van J. Simmons. Session number SYV 2006-4. Let's listen in.
I've been trying to introduce students in my classes to books that might further their reading on these key figures in history that we've been focused on, and generally focused on one book for each figure. I have three, which suggests his importance, I think, to a certain extent. Perhaps the most engaging of the three, though perhaps not the most scholarly, is a work that was published years and years and years ago by Bertram Wolff. Bertram Wolff was a expelled member of the party, the Communist Party, a member of the Comintern at the time, so this is kind of an inside voice. But he wrote a book called Three Who Made a Revolution, and it focuses on Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky. And so there's a kind of a biographical focus of each of these three individuals, and the interplay between particularly Trotsky and Lenin is just fascinating. You can tell it's an old book because it cost me $3.45 when I got it. That's a pretty good bargain, huh? But I think it's still in print because it is kind of a classic. And it gives you, it's still in print because it is kind of a classic. And it gives you some from it today to help us set context. I think the best biography that's been written on Lenin himself is by Adam Olin, called The Bolsheviks. It is a wonderful read. I was going back through it again and preparing for today's lesson. And it's just very substantive. It presents the best early biography of Lenin and his origins and background. I use it a lot to help us understand what it is that led Lenin to be as revolutionary as he was, as focused as he was, as a revolutionary figure. So, The Bolsheviks by Adam Olin. This was $2.95. So we're going back a bit, aren't we? This one is more current, and it was $15.95. This is by Richard Pipes. I remember I referred to Richard Pipes the other day when we were talking about geographical determinism and everything. That was one of Pipes' early books, and not nearly as solid as this. This is one that I think he completed as an emeriti faculty member at Harvard. And I think it's the strongest overview of the Russian Revolution that's been done to date. It is just a very thorough analysis. Not necessarily of Lenin alone, but of what happened. Isn't it intriguing that so many great dynasties just simply collapsed? The Habsburgs, the Qing dynasty that we're talking about in the context of Kangxi. I think the Romanov dynasty collapses more than it's toppled due to the pressures of the number of things.
More than it's toppled.
It wasn't so much that Lenin destroyed the Romanovs. World War I did, the failure of people to find bread and wood to stoke their fires, and it just collapsed. It was no longer functioning effectively. And Lenin came and gave it a little shove, and it was done. This is particularly good in conveying the failure of the Romanovs. They give Lenin the opportunity to seize power. I'm going to suggest to you today that that's in fact what this was. An orchestration of events by Lenin to achieve success. He wasn't any more entitled to rule what became the Soviet Union than a number of other folks. He just was more adept at seizing the moment and achieving success. I want to go to one theme that we've been dealing with in the 4 days I've been working with you, and this is drawn from Pipes. Here's what he says, Lenin and the origins of Bolshevism. He doesn't get to Lenin until the middle of the book, which suggests that he really is focusing on the factors leading to the revolution. He says, one need not believe that history is made by great men to appreciate the immense importance of Lenin for the Russian Revolution and the regime that issued from it. The regime probably would have fallen with or without Lenin. It is not only that the power which he accumulated allowed Lenin to exert a decisive influence on the course of events, but also that the regime which he established in October 1917 institutionalized, as it were, his personality. Lenin left his mark on Russian history because the party that toppled the Romanovs was his. The Bolshevik party had the temperament, the personality of V.I. Lenin. He had seen to that. And the government that was established afterwards had that personality too. The Bolshevik party was Lenin's creation as its founder. He conceived it in his own image, and overcoming all opposition from within and without, kept it on the course he had charted. The same party, on seizing power in October 1917, promptly eliminated all rival parties and organizations to become Russia's exclusive source of political authority. Communist Russia, therefore, has been from the beginning to an unusual extent a reflection of the mind and psyche of one man. His biography and its history are uniquely fused. It's an interesting observation, isn't it? We've asked this question, do great men make history? Do they alter the course of history? And what Pipe says is, you don't need to believe that. But then he turns right around and says, but Soviet Russia was Lenin's Russia. It was shaped by him, by the very nature of this individual. And we'll spend some time trying to sort all this out. I'll tell you, we're not going to get through all my notes today. But I want to apologize, because the last time we met, I was off clock. I had been starting at 4:45, and just inherently I thought I would end at 5:45, well, it would be 4:45. I had forgotten I started at 3:30, it was the end of 4:30, so I was bumbling along for 15 minutes beyond what I should have yesterday, not realizing that I was to close my remarks at 5:30.
This would be about to tell you.
Yeah, we worked on the value.
I think my wife was raising the hand. I'd like to begin today by beginning. I think we can do this with Lenin as we did with Mao more than we could with Peter or with Kangxi, because you know more about Lenin and Mao than you do these other two figures. But I'd like to ask you, how would you characterize V.I. Lenin? What qualities did he have that he left as legacy for the Soviet Union and left as legacy for the Bolshevik?
Ruthless.
I would say, yes, ruthless is the first word that comes to mind.
Okay. What term would the Russians use other than ruthless?
Strong.
Probably determined, or focused, or immovable. Ruthless has a bias, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's valid. Ruthless?
I'm going to say single-minded.
Okay. That would work too. Single-minded. What was his single-mindedness focused around, Gary?
Achieving his goals.
Achieving the goal.
And we want to discuss what those goals were. The goal for Lenin wasn't necessarily simply to create a Marxist state in Russia. The goal for Lenin was to use Russia as the vehicle to create an international arena. He hoped that Russia could be the springboard. And so, to a degree, he sacrificed the Russian Revolution for the broader cause, and failed. Any other qualities that characterize this man?
The country had pollution. He wrecked the country.
Yeah, well, he was dead by 24. I think Stalin does that more than Lenin.
He just said it in.
Yeah. Okay.
Atheistic?
Okay, that's not something that the biographers focus on very much, but it's true.
Anti-religion, maybe.
you'll find that as a young man, he was religious. His father was a servant of the Tsar, Russian Orthodox believer. His mother was probably of German ancestry and not too connected to the church. But Lenin, up to the age of 16 or 17, was quite involved in religion. We'll explore that in a minute. So in the end, atheistic, as he embraces Marxism, but in the beginning, not so. Any other characteristics?
Power-driven?
Okay.
Or did, or was he?
Inasmuch as he clearly was. But power-driven, not to necessarily accumulate power for himself, as to generate the leverage he needed to accomplish his objective. The single-mindedness is refers to that quite a bit. A term that scholars often use is dedicated. You, as much as you may dislike this figure, one cannot fail to recognize his devoutness to his cause. Axelrod, one of the other Marxists of the time, said of Lenin, "There is no other man who is absorbed by the revolution 24 hours a day, who has no other thoughts but the thought of revolution, and who, even when he sleeps, dreams of nothing." He lived, he died for revolution. We need to kind of sort out what drove into that. But he clearly was dedicated. And it was his dedication, the long hours he put in as revolutionary, his unstinted service for the revolution that won a lot of support for him.
I think you also have to define what you mean by revolution.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to that. we do. And that's going to be that as soon as we kind of characterize the qualities, I want to get to that. He was insightful. He had a better vision, I think, than most, at most times, sometimes he was not, of what the potential was for revolution, particularly in that crucial year of 1917, after the Romanovs had abdicated. The provisional government had been established, and now Lenin's trying to topple the provisional government and seize power for himself. He showed great insight there as to what the peasants wanted, what the workers wanted, the crisis created by involvement in the First World War, and so on and so forth. His insight is telling. The worse it is, the better, is a statement that's given to him. They have nothing to lose but their chains. If you could promise the worker power in the factories, if you could promise the peasants land, they had been thirsting for land ever since the Alexander II had emancipated the serfs but not given them enough land to really get by. He knew that if he could promise land to the tiller, and power to the Soviets, they would support him. And that shows a great deal of insight. You should know that he was, and this will go well here, quite ascetic in his case. He lived very frugally. He wanted for nothing because he was preoccupied with his revolutionary endeavors. And his wife, we'll introduce her to you later, was the same kind of person. The ideal for revolutionaries, Marxist revolutionaries at this time, was to be ascetic, to devote themselves to this cause and not anything else. He was persistent. And that's true of most great leaders, isn't it? Persistent. He suffered defeat, he came back. He suffered shortfall, he came back. Another word for that would be indomitable. I think he had that spirit, long-suffering. I mean, they're all persistent, indomitable, long-suffering. That, I think, is true. He was unbending. That, I think, is true. He was unbending.
knew what he wanted, and did not relent. And that was in arguments with his socialist or Marxist colleagues. It was in confrontation with the Romanovs or others as well.
That's sort of like a single-minded, though.
Well, single-minded suggests, yeah.
Not necessarily.
This suggests that you can be single-minded and yet be somewhat amenable to conversation and some kind of compromise. Lenin was not amenable to compromise at all. He was manipulative and not afraid to use what influence he had when. He was manipulative. He had a certain charisma. And I want to read from Pipes and give you a sense of that, and then we're going to move on. I'm just trying to give you some kind of sense of who this person is. Pipes talks about his charisma and how what gave him this charisma. But this unattractive man, he wasn't handsome, but he had kind of red hair, and he was balding, and everybody talks about it. He's not an impressive fellow on the outside. But this unattractive man glowed with an inner force that made people quickly forget their first impressions. His strength of will, indomitable discipline, energy, asceticism, and unshakable faith in the cause had an effect that can only be conveyed by the overused term charisma. According to Patrasov, this unprepossessing and coarse individual, devoid of charm, had a hypnotic impact. Plekhanov was respected, Martov loved, but they only followed unquestionably Lenin, the one indisputable leader, because Lenin alone embodied the phenomenon, rare everywhere, but especially in Russia, of a man of iron will, inexhaustible energy, combining a fanatical faith in the movement, in the cause, with an equal faith in himself. These were troubled times. And as you sort through the various revolutionary groups, and there were many of them, they were all kind of sorting out how to deal with the troubles of a world war that they were involved in and couldn't seem to extricate themselves from. A dynasty that was collapsing, a lack of any resources to speak of. Lenin was one person in the midst who had a clear vision and said, if we but do this, we can make things happen. The others were a little more uncertain. And that's particularly true, not just of the revolutionaries, but of the provisional government once it's established in February of 1917. Okay, we've introduced you to Lenin now.
Who established the provisional government? How was that?
The provisional government, we're going to get to this, but it came into existence when the Romanovs abdicated. And that was because there were riots in the streets of St. Petersburg because there was not adequate bread, not adequate fuel. The Tsar was off on the front trying to make his way back. But he was prevented by his own troops from returning. And in the vacuum, then, the Duma, which had been the legislature, which had been established as early as 1905 with the failed Russo-Japanese War, the Duma assumed power, and that became the provisional government. And it was a hodgepodge of Mensheviks and social revolutionaries and former Duma and Boyer members and so on. Now, having talked about Lenin and his qualities, can somebody help us by suggesting what he was trying to establish? What is the basic argument that Lenin is making as defined by economic determinism? How does he argue? What does he argue will lead to the dramatic change in Russia that he desires?
Dictatorship of the proletariat.
Okay. And why is the proletariat going to, how are they going to achieve this dictatorship?
I don't know.
Sounds like a good idea.
focal point is supposed to be the proletariat. Who are they?
Workers.
Okay. And Lenin has accepted Marx and Engels' ideas that revolution will occur in capitalist countries. Why? Marx and Engels hypothesized that revolution would first occur in places like Germany or in England. And what would be the cause of revolutionary change in these countries? By who?
By the
capital class.
Capital class, which is wealthy.
Right, good, good. So there would be a tension that develops between the industrialists, you see it in Dickens, don't you? The owners of the factories that exploit the workers in those factories. And ultimately, the dynamic, the tension that's created by this exploitation will lead the workers to rise up and seize power. The proletariat will rise up to seize power. The idea was, really, that the worker was productive enough, the proletariat was, that they would continue to produce adequate, even a surplus of goods in these factories, such that ultimately the industrialist would have no place to market the goods. In a society where the peasants are exploited, the workers are exploited, and you have a very small, affluent base, there's only so many, well, it wouldn't be stoves, so many, what would it be in 1900 that you can produce that can be purchased? And then once everyone has one of those, the workers don't have the money to purchase these goods. The peasant doesn't have the money. The factories can't go on producing goods that can no longer be sold in the marketplace. So the factories will shut down, and the workers will lose their jobs and will rise up and seize power. It's this dynamic of exploitation that will lead to the dramatic change that leads the worker to rise up and overthrow the industrialist. Marx and Engels felt that the industrialists were supported by the state, for the most part, by the institutions of religion, the institutions of bureaucracy and so forth, because it was to their advantage to support this. Lenin felt, as did other Marxists, that the revolution would first occur, as I said, in Germany or England. He was as surprised as everyone else, I think, when he ultimately achieved success. Why did the revolution occur first in Russia is the question. And Lenin would say, it was because there was a vanguard of the proletariat, foresighted revolutionaries, that led a less developed capitalist state. Because it was less developed, there shouldn't have been the same kind of tensions that exist between workers and industrialists in Germany and England. Russia wasn't there yet. It wasn't a fully capitalist country yet. It wasn't supposed to occur until those tensions developed. But he would say there was a vanguard of the proletariat, i.e. Lenin and his intellectual colleagues, that led the revolution and contributed to its success. He would also say that Marx and Engels failed to realize that in Germany, in France and Britain and these other developed countries, there were colonies. There was an empire. And so when goods were produced and no one else in England could produce or purchase those goods, you sent them to your empire. You sent them to India. People purchased them there. You got cheap raw materials from the colonies. You got rid of your surplus goods to the colonies. That took the lid off the pressure cooker, and the revolution didn't blow up. But in Russia, it did. And it's because of the foresight of Lenin. So what Lenin is trying to do, having secured power in Russia and created a Soviet state, almost immediately he creates what became known as the Communist International, the Comintern, to export revolution abroad. Where is he going to export it? He tries first to export it to England and to these other countries,
But he finds they're embroiled in a war, and the workers of Darnum are patriotic. They're going to support the state instead of topple the state because they don't want to lose the war. And so what he does then is he hypothesizes, and he says, if we can deny these countries their colonies, they'll have no place to discharge their surplus goods. And the pressure, the lid will go back on the pressure cooker, and revolution will explode in these countries. So the Comintern became very much engaged in fomenting revolution in China, in India, in developing Latin America, wherever they could create an unsettling environment for the empires, so that the pressure cooker. Okay, I've hopefully set context now, and I'm running out of time. There are a couple of interesting questions I want to suggest to you. First, I suggested this to you the other day. This is one truth I think that most of us will agree with. This is Engels, who wrote to Vera Zaslavich. Engels was, of course, Marx's colleague. Vera Zaslavich was an early socialist. He said, people who imagined that they made a revolution always saw next day that they did not know what they had been doing, and that the revolution which they made was nothing like the one they wanted to make. Did Lenin achieve success? Short term. He toppled the dynasty. He toppled the provisional government. At the end of 1917, the Bolsheviks are in control of St. Petersburg. A couple of weeks later, they're in control of Moscow, but barely. It took 3 years of civil war for them to wrest control of the rest of Russia, didn't it? But finally, by 1921 or so, Lenin can say, I am in control of the Soviet Union. But was he? No. If you read the last chapter of this this Olim text, it's really quite discouraging, because Lenin has suffered a couple of strokes. He's losing power. A political contest is emerging between Stalin and Trotsky and their cohorts on who will succeed Lenin. And Lenin has come to realize that his revolution has gone nowhere. There weren't enough intellectuals, there weren't enough supporters to his Bolshevik cause to run the state after he seized power. And so he's had to turn governance over to the bureaucracy. Yeah. And it was the old bureaucracy, or it was the Mensheviks and people that weren't committed to the same kind of revolution he was. He's a disenchanted, disillusioned man, because he knows the dream he had of creating. He's a disenchanted, disillusioned man. Because he knows the dream he had of creating a utopian Bolshevik Marxist state had failed in Russia, let alone failing to expand anywhere else. So I think that's a truism. Those who make revolution never quite realize their dreams.
At what point did the United States and European powers invade, and did it make any difference?
They invaded almost immediately after the success of the Bolsheviks. Why?
I was saying, did it make any difference?
Yes. Well, why did they invade? For those that are, you didn't realize that the White Armies, the armies that fought against the Bolsheviks for 3 years, many of you didn't realize that they were supported by the British and the French, Americans, the Japanese. We all got involved. So, I mean, if a Cold War developed between Lenin and the West, it was in part because we provoked it. We tried as best we could to reverse the seizure of power. Why? Because he had promised the peasants, particularly, that he'd get Russia out of the war. This is one of the insightful things that he did. He knew that a segment of society was war-weary, and he says, If there's one thing I'll do, I'll get you out of the war. And the Germans demanded draconian concessions, and he still signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and withdrew Russia from the war. The French, the British, the Americans wanted a two-front war against the Germans, because that, with Russia out of the war, the Germans could turn all their forces to the Western Front.
And so they sent their troops in to ally with the whites, and it didn't make a lot of difference. The Americans went into Vladivostok, combined with Japanese forces, and moved into Siberia. We got involved very early on. Well, back to this one truth. It's easier to topple a government than realize the dream you have of creating something different. And remember, I alluded the other day to Lenin discovers that. Mao certainly discovered it. I think Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney are discovering it now. I hope they discover it more quickly, but it's taking them a long time. Another truth, I think, that we discover from the 1917 revolution is that the great catalyst for change in 20th century world has been war. Wolf has an interesting observation about the impact of World War I on ultimately Lenin's success. Page 207. Our one agreed aim in World War I was to break up German militarism. It was no part of our original intention to break up the Habsburg and Ottoman empires, to create Czechoslovakia or resurrect Poland, to make a Russian revolution, to treble the size of Serbia and double that of Romania, to create Iraq and Estonia and Lithuania and a Jewish national home, or to give the keys of the Brenner and the Adriatic to Italy. Yet in the outcome, all these and much else sprang out of the war, while the one thing which we promised ourselves, the destruction of German militarism, we failed to achieve. They went to war to destroy the Germans, and they destroyed much of the rest of the world. The Habsburgs fall. I mean, think of the impact of that war. And then if you think of the impact of World War II on the nature of our world community, at times that was liberating, wasn't it? Because the great empires fell. The British lost India. The French reluctantly withdrew from Vietnam, and then we got involved, and in time we withdrew too. But the Vietnamese gained their independence. The Indonesians freed themselves from the Dutch. I mean, World War II was apocalyptic, wasn't it, in the impact that it had. There are many of us in the room that witnessed firsthand the Vietnam War. And think of the impact of that war on America, on our sense of who we are, on change, the 60s, and the revolution of the 60s, and whatnot. War is a catalyst for change. And in this case, it was this war that revealed, more than any other, the weaknesses of the Romanov dynasty and gave Lenin the opportunity to seize power as he wished to. Churchill said of Lenin, his aim to save the world, his method to blow it up. That was Lenin's strategy. There were a lot of revolutionaries in Russia that had adopted that strategy. The socialist revolutionaries, whose base was primarily the peasantry, beginning right after the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, began a wave of terrorism that you would not believe, similar to what's going on in Iraq today. And young, idealistic Russians, whenever they had an opportunity, would blow themselves up in the hopes of destroying a Romanov official, or Romanov family member. And it just went on and on and on. Plekhanov said of Lenin, Lenin desires unity as a man desires unity with a piece of bread. He swallows it. Lenin was focused. He was not afraid of using the war to his own advantage. And the war is what, more than anything else, debilitated the Romanovs. What did the war reveal? What kind of opportunity did the war provide to Lenin? I've got about six or seven things I want to suggest to you. Here's how Lenin used the war to his own advantage. First, the war revealed as never before the weaknesses of Nicholas II and Alexander, his emperor. The weakness of the Romanov court. the war was absolutely devastating to the Russians. They joined the First World War because they felt, because of the nature of the alliances that they had signed, that they had no recourse but to do so. But there was not a nation involved in World War I that suffered more than the Russians did. The Russians mobilized 15.5 million soldiers for the war. They suffered more casualties than any other combatant. We've lost 2,500, is that right? 2,500 in Iraq. They lost 1,650,000 in World War I. They had 3,850,000 casualties, people that came back maimed. They had 2,410,000 soldiers that were imprisoned in the war. The Romanovs were absolutely ineffectual in dealing with the war. Men were sent off to battle without weapons. There were instances where half of a division went into battle with no rifles. And they gave them mattocks and swords and told them to charge the lines. And when someone with a rifle fell, they would pick it up and use it. Some of these soldiers had 2 rounds of ammunition a day. They were arrayed against batteries, one cannon contesting against 50. And that cannon was limited ammunition. The war revealed as never before the ineffectualness of the Tsarist government and their lack of preparedness for it. Secondly, the war created the bread and fuel shortages in St. Petersburg that led to the fall of the dynasty. The movement to overthrow the Romanov dynasty was not a movement throughout all of Russia. It was centered primarily in St. Petersburg. And then only later in Moscow. Most of the peasants in Russia were still supportive of the war effort of the Romanovs, even though there were millions, tens of thousands of them dying and being wounded in that war. It was the bread and fuel shortages in St. Petersburg because of logistical nightmares and so on and so forth. The particularly harsh winter, and fuel meant people were cold or freezing. That's what tripped the revolution. Third, the Romanov dynasty failed. Jack?
Excuse me just a second. I'm working up above here, so have everybody go on this that way, please. Thank you.
The Romanov dynasty committed itself to the war, and it was fairly popular, and they failed to realize that the war ultimately would destroy them. They didn't make any effort to withdraw themselves from this engagement. They had been promised certain concessions in the Crimean area, Turkic land and whatnot, because Turkey was allied with Germany. There were promises of some booty at the end of the war, but mostly it was the pride of the Romanovs. Lenin was the only figure during this time period that realized that the Russians would fail in the war and committed Russia to get out of the war. The other thing that Lenin did that was wise was he promised land to the peasants immediately once the war ended. And the peasants were land hungry and the Romanovs had delayed in providing that. He promised power to the Soviets. His slogan was, war to the palaces, peace to the huts, expropriate the expropriators. He had this ability to clarify and make promises to people that engaged them and committed them to his cause. And Chamberlain says of this, of this whole event, the collapse of the Romanov autocracy in March 1917 was one of the most leaderless, spontaneous, anonymous revolutions of all time. While almost every thoughtful observer in Russia in the winter of 16 and 17 foresaw the likelihood of the crash of the existing regime, no one, even among the revolutionary leaders, realized that the strikes and bread riots which broke out in Petrograd on March 8th would culminate in the mutiny of the garrison and the overthrow of the government 4 days later. And then Feinsod says,
The enemies of Bolshevism were numerous, but they were also weak, poorly organized, divided, and apathetic. The strategy of Lenin was calculated to emphasize the divisions. Lenin played on the weaknesses of the Romanovs, on the weaknesses created by the war, on the unwillingness of the other people who were critical of the dynasty act, and he took the bull by the horns and achieved success. Let me ask you, was it inevitable that the Romanov dynasty would fall?
Yes.
Yes.
I think once they got involved in World War I, it was, unless they got out of it. But I just wanted to clarify that had they not got involved in World War I in 1914, they were making quite dramatic progress. The war is what did it. I keep saying, wars are debilitating. I don't care what war it is, Vietnam or Iraq or whatever. They drain the resources and directions of government away from what the government should be doing and focus on other things. And that's what happened with the Romans. Beginning in 1905, after the failed Russo-Japanese War, the Romanov dynasty committed itself to constitutional monarchy. They created a Duma and allowed elections to begin to be held at the local and the national level. And they were moving towards sharing power with elected representatives. That's promising, isn't it? Had the war not come, the Duma would have, I think, had a greater voice in government, and ultimately some kind of compromise might have been reached where the Romanovs would clearly have shared power with legislative bodies, and you could have had something similar to what happened in England. Right after the Russo-Japanese War, too, the Prime Minister, a fellow named Peter Stolypin, decided that what the Romanovs needed to do was wager on the strong. The strong in Russia at the time were the peasants. They couldn't be strong. Peasants were mostly emancipated serfs with very little landholdings. What the Romanovs decided to do was to enhance the wealth of the peasantry by giving them more land, buying land from the former landlords and allocating it to the peasants, the former serfs, expropriating church land and government land and giving it to the peasants. Why the peasants? Because peasants tend to be conservative. And peasants revered the emperor. And there are a lot of statistics that show that this was working before 1914, that the peasants were becoming a viable group. When Stalin seizes power after Lenin's death, one of the first things he does is he goes into Ukraine and in parts of South Russia, and he has they were called kulaks at the time, the private farmers of Ukraine and elsewhere. They were against Marxist-Leninism. They were against communization of their land. The peasants had become strong, and how did Stalin ultimately defeat them? He sent them off to the gulags. Had the war not come, you could hypothesize that it might have been possible that this base, the peasants were about 85% of the populace of Russia, that this base could have become a bulwark for the dynasty and the dynasty. So it wasn't inevitable. It wasn't necessarily a thing that would happen until World War I. Now, just to focus a little bit, how did the Bolsheviks ultimately seize power? It just unfolds kind of lockstep. In February, there were bread riots and fuel riots in the cities. And they grow until from March 8th to 11th, 1917, the demonstrators are more or less completely out of control. There were no military garrisons in St. Petersburg ready to control these forces. And there were independent groups, mostly focused around Marxists and other revolutionaries, that could wield power or had the loyalty of troops sympathetic to them. They could wield power to the advantage of the revolutionaries. The emperor decided that what he would do is call in reserves from the front to
to withdraw them from the front to bring stability to St. Petersburg. The trains were stopped by demonstrators. The soldiers fraternized with the demonstrators and refused to march back to Beijing. Nicholas failed to respond in any other fashion. By March 15th, he had decided to abdicate rather than to invite civil war. He was a noble man to a certain respect, and did not want civil war to embroil Russia such that the Germans could overrun them. So he abdicates on March 15th. In the vacuum left by the abdicating emperor, the former Duma assumed control. It was a provisional government. The provisional government was provisional because they said there needed to be a constituent assembly, there needed to be elections to elect a representative body to run all of Russia. They were moving towards democracy. But the provisional government failed to realize that in the time between the fall of the government and the mounting of an election, the Bolsheviks might seize power. They were unwilling to make major changes, i.e. withdraw from the war, give land to the peasants, because they weren't elected to do so. Many of them had been appointed. Many of them did not feel they had a mandate. They were waiting for a constituent assembly, and that was to occur the end of November. Lenin seizes power just before that election, because he knows he can't win that election. And so the provisional government just half-heartedly rules, but fails to meet the basic needs of the people. At the same time, Lenin is messing around with what became known as Soviets. The Soviets were the workers' groups in the city that had organized themselves. They were controlled for the most part by Mensheviks and social revolutionaries and others. Lenin only had a toehold in the overall Soviet movement. They weren't very sympathetic to Lenin, but Lenin was manipulative and worked the system such that ultimately he's able to subvert both the provisional government and the Soviets and seize power. What I'm suggesting is that on November 7th, when the Bolsheviks occupied strategic places in the city and declared the revolution a success, they did so as just one minor party in this broader context of things. They seized power. This was a coup by a small group of conspirators focused around Lenin's vision. It did not represent the broad spectrum of revolutionaries. It certainly did not represent the interests of the peasantry, necessarily even the interests of the workers. If you read Adam Woolen, he says that he could only find one true proletarian in the whole Leninist camp. These were mostly intellectuals, professional revolutionaries that had lived in exile, where they were safe, while a lot of the fodder of the revolution were killing themselves, trying to assassinate czars and everything else. Lenin was very protective of himself and lived in exile most of the period from 1905 to 17. He only comes back when it's safe to come back. When there was a failed July attempt to seize power, he flees to Finland and then only comes back when he's safe. Not that he was a coward, just that he was single-minded and knew that if he wasn't there, the revolution wouldn't succeed, I suppose. He had great courage, but he did not. His brother had been killed as a revolutionary, and he wasn't going to follow that same course. So it wasn't a proletarian revolution. It was a coup d'etat orchestrated by the Bolsheviks, as evidenced by the fact that it took them 3 years finally to secure power. And they only secured these draconian methods of withdrawing from World War I, promising land to the tiller and so on and so forth. Okay. We've got about 10 minutes now to deal with who this guy is and set the context for him. Do you know much about Lenin?
All about it.
his father was a servant of the Tsarist state. Most Marxists don't want to really reflect on the background of Lenin, because it's full of all kinds of sort of things that don't suggest he was a true revolutionary. His father was a faithful servant of the Tsar, a faithful son of the Orthodox Church. Lenin was probably not a pure Russian. We think that both he and his father and his mother were probably common people. They were from the Astrakhan area. The Kalmyks were probably a Mongol people. They probably had mixtures. This was a real melting pot at this time. But Lenin has features that suggest that he's Asian as well as European.
But he was from Astrakhan?
The family goes back to that area.
Where is that?
Astrakhan is up the Volga River. If that helps. It's up the Volga River from the Baltic, from the Black Sea.
Okay.
It's just south of the Ural Mountains. So it's right in that corridor between Asiatic Russia and European Russia.
On the southern end of the Urals?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. A pivotal place, just overrun constantly by nomadic peoples. So that explains the diversity in their background. His father was upwardly mobile. He was born to a poor father and an illiterate mother. But his father was supported as he sought an education by an older brother that somehow had acquired some wealth. And so his father had some spunk, and that's what created the upward mobility that ultimately placed Lenin in the home of what became, his father became an important official in the Tsarist government. He was a school inspector and would wander around that part of Russia making sure that schools were being created and run effectively, a dutiful servant of the state. Lenin, I suggested that Lenin's mother was the daughter of a doctor from an affluent family, perhaps of German descent. Lenin was born in 1870, the second son and third child of this marriage. They lived in the Volga region. We know that Lenin, to the age of about 16, was a good student, somewhat religious in his focus, a dutiful son, not a revolutionary at all. Most scholars, when we try to trace the origins of Lenin's revolutionary activities, trace it to the arrest of his older brother, Alexander. Alexander plotted to assassinate Alexander III, the emperor. Alexander II had been assassinated in 1861, I think it was, and this boy planned to assassinate the succeeding emperor. He and the conspirators around him were discovered. He was tried in open court. He did not renounce the fact that he was attempting to assassinate the Tsar. He took great pride in his action, as a lot of young revolutionaries did. On the podium, as he was providing some defense for himself, he said, "Terror is the only form of defense by which a minority strong only in its spiritual strength and the consciousness of its righteousness can combat the physical power of the majority. Among the Russian people, there will always be found many people who are so devoted to their ideas and who feel so bitterly in the unhappiness of their country that it will not be a sacrifice for them to offer their lives." He was an idealistic young man who saw or sensed the wrong in dynastic government and tried to assassinate the Tsar. His mother had some connections. His father was dead by then. But his mother had some connections and pled with him to ask for clemency or mercy, which would have meant that he might have been sent just simply into exile. And that was often the case. The Romanovs were amazingly gracious in dealing with the people that were trying to kill him. But he would not do so. And so he was hanged in May of 1887, his brother was. At the time Alexander was hanged, Lenin, a young boy, I think about 16, was taking his exams in his gymnasium. He had been attending the Simbirsk Gymnasium. These exams were the defining point in young Russian lives. They were very rigorous, dealing with all aspects of learning. And a lot of kids would have nervous breakdowns before they even took the exams. Can you imagine Lenin preparing for the exams, knowing that his brother is now being tried and likely to be executed? Well, he prepared for the exams, he took them, and he was awarded the gold medal for his gymnasia, which meant he placed first in the examinations. Lenin was a very bright fellow. Alexander, his older brother, had received the same award, as had his sister Anna. So he came from a very bright family. On the recommendation, these were national exams. Olin talks about and says they're much more rigorous than anything we prepare for as we try to get into grad school or whatever. These were really tough. He said, noted on the announcement that he had received the gold medal was that he had exemplary behavior, a keen interest in his studies. Alexander Kerensky, who was the head of the provisional government that Lenin ultimately overthrew, Kerensky was the director of the gymnasium and noted that Lenin was a wonderful young man, except he was a little too reserved and lacked any friends. This was a true geek. I mean, he just focused on his studies. When Lenin finished the exams in the gymnasium, surprisingly, he was still allowed to enter university, even though his brother had been just executed for conspiring to assassinate the Tsar. Lenin entered the University of Kazan, which was a major university out of the Volga region, but lasted only about 3 or 4 months before there was a demonstration at the University of Kazan for more freedoms in the university. There were several hundred students at the university that demonstrated, and through universities all through Russia. 45 students were ultimately expelled for that, and Lenin was one of them. Probably because he had red hair, and he could be identified in the group of students, but more likely because his brother had tried to assassinate the Tsar. As long as Lenin behaved himself, the dynasty would not have come down on him. But they were watching it more closely than others because of his brother. Lenin, expelled from the university, now waited 3.5 years before he gained any opportunity for advancement. Finally, his mother went to St. Petersburg, again because of his father's long service to the dynasty. His mother had some leverage, and Lenin gained the opportunity to take a law exam. He had not had any formal training, but had been studying on his own. And he took a national law board exam and placed first. And so he became a lawyer. From there on, Lenin first practiced law in the Volga region, not too widely. It's at that time, having been expelled from college, having now passed the law boards, that he begins to dabble in revolution and begins to embrace Marxism. He makes a short trip to Europe, meets with Plekhanov and other socialists, comes back, establishes a brief law career in St. Petersburg in a sympathetic law firm to people that were engaged, as he was, in these kinds of activities. And at that point, it's now 1889, he becomes a lawyer. Shortly after that, he's discovered for being involved in some conspiratorial things in St. Petersburg and is sent into exile into Siberia. But it was a free exile, which meant he was free to
do his own activities as long as he stayed in one place. And there he built the connections that he needed so that when he went back to, well, he left the country after exile and then became a professional revolutionary, living in Belgium and in Switzerland, all over the place. If I had more time, we could have a ball talking about Lenin as he develops his reputation as a revolutionary abroad. But he's really abroad, you see, for 15 years or so before the revolution ever occurs. And he's in circles of Mensheviks and SRs and populists, and I mean, there are a whole range of different groups that are formulating or conspiring to overthrow the Romanov. And he emerges only in the context of 1917. His revolution fails, so that's it. He succeeds in achieving power, but in the end, his dreams of creating a utopia fail. Easy to seize, but very difficult to achieve. Any questions?
How did he die? Naturally?
He died of a number of strokes.
Oh, can you do it again? But didn't they kill him?
Yeah,
in 1924?
And they killed him in part because after he had his first stroke, he didn't slow down. And he just kept working. He could not stop working. Drafting memos, writing treatises, micromanaging the state that was slowly crumbling around him. And before he died, the whole circle of people around him were conspiring to seize power. And it was just, it must have just been an awful situation.
What age?
Let's see, he died in 24. He was born in
70.
He wasn't very old. I want to pay dinner. I want to invite you to my presentation tomorrow, which is going to be very different. It's about Joseph Smith. And so there are two people we've dealt with that inherited great man said, it's Kang Xi and Mao. There are two that Peter the Great and Kang Xi inherited leverage to be great men. Lenin and Mao did not, and Joseph Smith certainly did not. But I think you know, most of you know that I am LDS. I've been at Augustana College for 27 years. And for many of those people, I've been the person they've asked questions about and wanted to know the strange church that I belong to. And so I decided that what I would do is give you kind of set Joseph Smith in historical context. When I was young, there were less than a million of us. Now there are over 13 million of us, which just boggles my mind. When I served as a young Mormon missionary in Hong Kong, I went up for a week to Salt Lake City, and there were about 200 of us that would go out each week to serve as missionaries. There are 60,000 of them out now. It's quite an incredible phenomenon, and quite disconcerting to many of you. I understand that. And what I want to do is try to set this church I belong to in some kind of historical perspective. And I thought I'd do that by just talking a little bit about Joseph. I don't want to get into the doctrinal stuff. I think that would be counterproductive. But this is a fascinating young man who really rises from a very poor family to become quite a charismatic and influential figure before his martyrdom, his death in 1844. So that's what we'll do in the bowling alley tomorrow.